Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the light. My guest today is Jerry Cannon, and when semi-retired in 1991 whilst living in the USA, he unintentionally, that's what he calls it, became involved to find the Ark of the Covenant, although it wasn't at the time something he'd known about. And as a result of that, he's had quite an extraordinary life since then, going to Egypt on a number of occasions. So welcome to the program, Jerry.
Hi, thanks for having me. I hope everybody can hear, because I'm down in southern Spain, about 20 miles from Gibraltar, and Gibraltar was where Plato said the Pillars of Hercules, in front of that somewhere in the Atlantic would be Atlantis, and I can virtually see the Pillars of Hercules on a clear night.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, you're evidently a very keen archaeologist. It might in some ways be looked upon as a rather unusual interest, but how long ago was it that you became interested in archaeology, and what sort of brought it about?
Well, I'm not an actual archaeologist, but a lot of people are calling it psychic archaeology, because we've picked up a lot of information psychically and through various psychics, and everything was proved 100%. So I think it all actually started many, many years ago when I had a car accident. And sort of a near-death experience. It was in London at the time, and probably around about 1964, 65. I was in a car, and there was no sign posted in those days on the little back streets of London. And I went over an intersection, another guy come the other way, and my car got hit. We hit collided, and I rolled over 7 times, and the car rolled over and hit a brick wall. Seemed to be smashed to smithereens, but the window was open, and I just stepped out as though nothing had happened. When I got out, a lot of people passing by were saying, "Oh, bet the guy must be dead who's in there." And I turned around and said, "You better pinch me, because I don't think I'm a ghost." And that was my first experience with something extraordinary. But around about that time, I got involved with by seeing the psychic part of life. I was had to go to an umbrella shop to have it repaired many years ago, and I'll go on to this, because then I'll go on to the main subject. And what happened was, when I walked into this shop, and an elderly woman's at the back of the shop, it's a very dismal old shop, and she called out, "Is Jack there?" And I said, "No, I'm not Jack, I'm just a customer." She says, "No, your father's here." And my father's name was Jack. And
yes.
I says, "Well, what makes you say that?" She said, "Well, I'm picking up that your father is here and his name is Jack." And then she went on to tell me that my brother-in-law is dangerously in hospital and is going to meet my father soon. He's going to die. And my brother-in-law was ill. He had Parkinson's disease. And after a few weeks later, he died. So I got a bit frightened when this woman was telling me all this. I just ran out the shop. First time I had been in touch with what I call a psychic. But then a few months later, my wife said, "Go and see another psychic guy." And he didn't want to charge me to do anything. And he started telling me about, I was in the furniture business, and he had no idea I was. Then he says, "I'm going to import some furniture from Spain," and I never thought I would. He said, "The man who's going to help me is a guy called Manuel. It's a big factory, and you'll be standing under a chandelier where all this happens. And then I can see a wedding ring on your pillar broken." They come up with all this stuff. And then so I see a lot of pictures being stuck on something, and you're making some money. And about 6 months later, I was importing furniture from Spain, actually, where I am now, and the guy in charge of the factory couldn't speak English, but they brought another guy out whose name was Manuel, and under a big chandelier, they put me into business selling all this furniture. And that night, when I woke up in the morning, on my pillow was my wedding ring broken. And I thought, well, how did these guys know all this? And sticking on the picture was, I don't know whether you remember about the pub mirrors. Remember pub mirrors years ago?
Covered
all the pictures on. Well, that's the business we got on, and we were sticking on lots of pictures, and I made a little bit of money on that. But let me start when I went to America, immigrated to America, and we bought our dream home in Las Vegas, where I semi-retired. And when I semi-retired, I went into learning a course on travel agency. And I learned a bit about that, and I was doing that from a room, which was an office in one of the rooms. But it was on a Chinese New Year, I think, where it all triggered off. My wife, actually, Mary, is Chinese. I had a vivid dream of numbers. The numbers were 3, 6, and 9. And these numbers were floating around me seemed to be all through my dream, the whole lot. And I woke up in the morning, and I told my wife, and she said, well, number 9 is a special number. In Chinese, it means longevity. And in fact, the Beijing emperor, they have to bow down to him about 9 times every time. And in Kowloon, which is one of the islands near Hong Kong, that's actually called 9 dragons. Oh. And I later on calculated a number which was quite interesting, which I'll talk about later, but I'll tell you what happened with the number. I was working on this number 9, and I found that every time you multiply 9 with another number, it's always adds up to 9. 9 threes are 27, 2 and 7 is 9, 4 nines are 36, 3 and 6, whatever your number do with 9. But I come up with a very special number. What I did was I went to Genesis in the Bible, and I calculated the 7 days of creation, and I divided into one entity or God or whatever you want to call it. And I come up with a number. When you divide 7s into 1, it's a special number. It's number 142857.142857. It goes on to infinity. It does not stop. And it was quite unusual, because 142857 are all the cardinal numbers except 3, 6, or 9. But when you add up 1 plus 4, 2, 8, 5, and 7, it adds up to 9 when you do the calculations. But anyhow, I'll go further on that later. But I'm in Las Vegas office in my room one morning, and on the wall was a huge map of the world. And I had to get up about 7 o'clock in the morning, because in Vegas a different time change to New York, and I was waiting for a call to come in there from a travel company. And my gaze was fixed on this wall map, and I don't know why, but I walked over to the map, and I felt there was something important in the middle of the map. So I took a large ruler and went from top left to the bottom right, and top right to the bottom left, made a cross, and it was somewhere in Africa. And I put my ruler down, put my finger on the spot, and my index finger moved over a couple of inches to the right, which ended up landed in the middle of the western desert in Egypt, near Cairo. And my finger got red hot. It started getting warm, red hot, and I pulled it away, and I got a bit nervous. And when I spoke to my wife, I said, this is the center of the world, that it seems there's something in there which is powerful and has to be found. And she said, no, get on with work, this is all rubbish. Anyhow, around that time, we met a guy in Las Vegas who was a scientist. He was a very religious Mormon, but he found a way to manufacture concrete, but 10 times harder than normal concrete. And he would put in some sort of a resin mixture in any sort of substance, and it would go 8 to 10 times harder as concrete. And he had this invention, and he had it all tested. In fact, he came to our home at the time, and he brought over a block of salt, small block, about 4 inches square, and he gave me a sledgehammer, and I couldn't break it. It nearly broke the sledgehammer. It was so powerful that it did that. But when we met this guy, he says, well, see if you can promote it. I can't do anything in America because his accountant apparently had found out that this guy, what he could do, and he got all his clients to invest money, and the guy did a runner or went off with about $3 million, and this poor Mormon was left holding the can, religious man, and they took everything away from him except some of the samples. And I had all the testing, and this brought us over to England, and I started getting involved. I was in all the newspapers and radio, television. It was the time when the Kuwait war ended, and they were putting out the fires. I don't know if you remember the oil fires, and this was supposed to be done it. But to cut a long story short, he even found out methods of picking up sand and making continually pipeline in the desert. Now, I didn't know what all this was for at the time, because I got stopped. The solicitor wrote to me. They found out I was promoting this in England, and they said, you've got to stop. And I had all these samples to take back, and when I got back, the scientist disappeared. They didn't know what happened to him for a few years. Later, I found out that he died. But this promoting us to go to Spain. All things had to happen, I suppose. It's a lot of synchronization. And my wife said, well, if we're going to go to England to promote this, well, I don't want to live in England. It's too cold. Let's go over to Spain. It's warmer. And yeah. We found a place in Spain where we're going to live, and we sold our house in Las Vegas. But before we did that, she was taking lessons and learning Spanish, and she couldn't quite get the language properly. So I suggested, let's get a hypnotist and see if they can regress you, or whatever this word regressing, into a past life where you might be able to speak Spanish or learn the dialogue and pronounce it better. And we did this, and we found an actual woman who could do all these things. And free of charge, hypnotist, apparently what she'd do, she used to go with people who were ill, she used to go into their past life and find out where this root of the illness was, and she was quite a lot of them. She was quite well known. But she then told us about automatic writing. And I said, what is this automatic writing? And she says, well, you put a pencil in your hand or pen, put it on paper, and just let your mind go blank, and it might start writing. And then she also spoke about walk-ins. Do you know what a walk-in is?
No. Oh, yes, of course I do. Yes, yes.
Walk-in is where a spirit or an entity enters someone's body and guides them or does something. It's possibly where a lot of inventors pick up their inventions, because someone might have done it before, and this walk-in could have gone in and told him what to do and stuff like that, whatever. Anyhow, one morning I'm sitting in my office, same office, and I'm doodling, and I thought to myself, well, maybe what this automatic writing, I'll give it a try. So I've got a blank piece of paper and put a pen in my hand, close my eyes, I put it down, and after about a minute, or not even that, my hand started moving. And I looked down, opened my eyes, and there were three words written on the page, and it says FINDTHEARK, find the ark.
Right.
And I said, what the hell does this mean? I don't know what this means. Why did I write down find the ark? First of all, I don't know what ark talking about. And why did these words come up? So I closed my eyes, and it happened three times, the same words, find the ark. I closed my eyes the fourth time, and I'm saying to myself, what is all this? Where is all this coming from? Who's giving me these names and numbers about find the ark? And I don't even know what it is. And I opened my eyes after it started writing again, and a word came up on the page of M-O-S-E-C, Mosec, M-O-S-E-C, I pronounce it, Mosec. And I thought, what's this Mosec come up? And I closed my eyes, and it come up three times, Mosec, Mosec, Mosec. And then find the ark, find the ark, find the ark. And I thought, well, it can't be Moses. I've never heard of a man named Mosec. I've heard of Moses. And I'm saying to myself, is this Moses? And the skin on the page came up, no, my name is Mosec, M-O-S-E-C. And this seemed very, very strange. So I put my finger down again with a pen on a page, closed my eyes, and this time my hand went right across, well, I'm right-handed, went across the desk onto the left-hand side of the desk, and I'm making a cross and a circle, across the circle in one area. And I opened up my eyes, and on my desk, and believe it or not, because I've actually got the book here in front of me, there was a map of the, it was called the Times World Atlas. I don't know if you heard of that time, big, large book, very big book, Atlas book. And it was open to the map of the world. It was on my bookshelf, and I don't know why it got on the desk, because there'd be no reason why I wanted that book. There's no reason why I'd be looking at that book. But with the cross and the circle that I've been doing was exactly the same spot where my finger got hot, which was in the Western Desert in Egypt. And I just didn't know what it was all about. It was amazing, and I just couldn't believe it. The book wasn't there. Anyhow, my wife said, let's go and talk to this girl, this hypnosis. Her name is Evelyn, and see what she comes of it. And she put me under hypnosis and regressed me. And apparently I went back into time, the time of Moses collecting the Ten Commandments. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't know too much about the Ten Commandments at the time. I didn't even know the Ark or anything else. But then we went off to, Spain. But before we go on to that, can I tell you a little bit about, or your listeners a little bit about the Ark of the Covenant and what it is? Some may know, some may not know.
Oh, please do, yes, yes.
Okay, well, the Exodus, where Moses, story of Moses started and where it finished, the Exodus, nobody knows exactly the date of the Exodus. A lot of scholars believed it was around 1440 BC. The rabbi scholars think it's about 1313 BC. So there's 100 or maybe 200 years span of when it actually was. And so far there's been no proof that the Exodus actually happened. Not saying that there's no archaeological evidence. Not saying that there can't be any archaeological evidence, because, you know, things pop up all the time. But it could have possibly been that when the Pharaoh was humiliated, taking the children of Israel when they all left Egypt, and apparently the children of Israel weren't all Hebrews, they were everyone who was in bondage, so that there were non-Hebrews too there, when they went on the Exodus. But when they went on the Exodus, Moses, who led them there, told the children of Israel that when you leave Egypt, you have to bring gold and jewelry with you. Now, why the hell would they need gold and jewelry if they're going out in the desert or going to the promised land, which had probably taken some time to be there? Surely they would have needed food and livestock or weapons, yeah, or something going on that treacherous track. Three times it said, not once, twice, but three times, bring gold and jewelry. And apparently he must have known he had to make the Ark of the Covenant, which was made with pure gold. He needed as much gold as he could. The Ark of the Covenant was made, specifically made, because Moses had received on in Mount Sinai, and nobody really believes where that is, that it was also called Mount Horeb. Some say it's down in the Sinai, near St. Catherine's Monastery. Some people say it's in Arabia. I believe it's possibly in northern Sinai, but that's another story. After he got the Ten Commandments, which were either on stone, so it says, but stone can also be crystal, and I believe if they had any power or anything special, they may even be celestial origin. There's a possible chance, only a possible chance, I mean, you know, don't say this is true, but there's a possible chance that if Moses was brought up by the pharaohs as a prince, he would have had carte blanche and would have known all about the pyramids and known all the secret chambers in there. And there could have been the real ark with these crystals in it, in there, which he knew about. And when he went on the Exodus, he couldn't take out the gold box because it was quite heavy. I'll explain that in a second, but he could have taken out these crystals or tablets of stone with knowledge for mankind or commandments, whatever was on it, to tell the children of Israel about it when he got down to this Mount Sinai, went up the mountain. But when he went up the mountain, he came down with these, and he saw that they were impatient because he went up there for quite a long time, and that they used their gold and built a golden calf and worshipped that. Did you know a little bit about that or not?
Yes, indeed, yes. I've read the story, yes.
You know the story. Okay, so when he saw all this, naturally he says, no, this is blasphemy, you mustn't do this, we've got to use that gold, bless it, whatever, it's got to be done, it's got to be used to make a special box to put in these tablets of stone or whatever they were to preserve them. And they made this box with acacia wood, now from the acacia tree. The reason why they must have used this was two reasons. First of all, acacia trees were known to be in the desert, grow in the desert. And the other thing is with an acacia wood, it's a very, very hard wood, has a beautiful grain, but most woods, insects and woodworm can get into it, but with acacia wood, it cannot. No insects can penetrate acacia wood. So they must have used this because it would have been to preserve anything in there. And then they lined it inside and outside with pure gold. That's why Moses wanted the gold. And it was pure gold, beaten gold, and they put it on there. I don't think it was very ornate. And they put on two carrying poles, so it could be quite heavy. There'd be four guys to carry it, one either side on the front and one either side on the back. And on top of it, they put these cherubs or figures on the top, because it's supposed to have been guarding or protecting the what they call the mercy seat, where God's supposed to have spoken to the priest or whatever it was from the top of this box. Now, the box size was 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5 cubics in size. Now, a cubic in those days, well, in our days, is equivalent to about 18 inches. But they measured it roughly from the man's tip of the finger to his elbow, and you'll find that's around about 18 inches. I know some guys are bigger than others, but I suppose at that time they're all near enough the same size or whatever. But the cubic is normally about 18 inches. You can look it up on the internet. So that makes the box about 45 inches long by 27 inches high by 27 inches in width. And of course there you've got all your number nines again, because you've got 45, which is 4 and 5 is 9. You've got 2 and 7, which is another 9 on the width, and 2 and 7 inches on the other side, you've got another 9. So that gives us all those 9s again. Now, right. On top of the box, on top of this mercy seat, there were two guards, call them cherubs or cherub, the actual Hebrew word from the Old Testament, what they were called, cherubim. And there's been a lot of drawings and illustrations and pictures of different people come up with different ideas of what these cherubim look like. Some people say they were angels with a bird's head, and that the bird's wings actually tipped each other over the top. You can picture one bird on one side and one on the other with their wings touching. But I believe that if these were angels, then why should they only represent angels for mankind? So I come up with an idea. Everybody thought it was crazy at the time, that it would have four heads. The creature would have a head of a man to represent mankind, the head of a wild beast for all the wild beings, another one, a cow for domestic, and the body would be of a serpent, or anything that swims or anything that crawls, so it would cover everything of creation. And a lot of people thought I was crazy at the time, but I looked into the Bible and I found a chapter in Exodus which states that the cherubim did have four heads and they did have a serpent's body. And I went a bit further on that. Somebody got me an ancient Bible an illustrated Bible, which I've got a picture of. In fact, it's on my website. And this picture of this shows these cherubims, or whatever you want to call them, cherubs, having four heads and also a serpent's body. It was all on this ancient Bible. So someone come up with a similar thing. So whatever I thought about wasn't that bad. Anyhow, we went and we got over to Spain. And when we were in Spain, my wife, we had to do a lot of work on the house, getting everything ready. And my wife had a sort of a frozen shoulder. You know what that is when you get a pain in your shoulder? It's a, they call it frozen shoulder. You know what that is?
Yes.
And somebody says, well, the doctors couldn't cure that. The doctor says it would go away by itself. There's no really cure for it. And somebody suggested going to one of these faith healers, and there was a one of these exhibitions going on where a lot of psychic people all get together, and she went to a couple of them. That they didn't help, were a waste of time. But we met somebody there who was a friend of ours, and says, well, they know of a woman who does predicts, she's a psychic, and maybe she can do something for my wife. So I said, well, my wife's birthday that weekend, maybe she can come over to the house and give her a reading. I knew these psychics, and the psychics are good for the past, what I could see. Anyhow, she came over, it looked like a gypsy sort of woman. Her name was Giovanna. She wasn't that old. I think she was probably in about in middle 30s. And she gave my wife a reading. At that time, it cost me, I put it in dollars, around about $30. And it's a complete waste of time. Whatever she told her was a lot of junk. And as she's leaving, she turned around and she says, I think I'd better give you a reading as well. I says, well, I don't want to waste, I thought to myself, I don't want to waste another $30, you know. I just said, no, don't worry, just bye-bye, thank you very much. Oh, no, she says, I want to give you a reading, I don't want to charge you. I says, okay, let's, if you're not charging me, maybe you can give me 10 readings. Anyway, so I sat down in front of her, and after a few minutes, she astonished me by saying, I can see numbers floating around you. I can see the number 3, 6, and 9 all floating around you. And she says that you're looking for a box in the desert, and it's a gold box. And I just let her continue. She said, I don't know what the box is, but I know you're looking for it. She says, and if you want to find it, you should go through all your notes, and she knew nothing about me. No, but in fact, I didn't tell anybody in Spain what I was doing. They might have thrown me out of the country if they talked to me, think I'm mental. She says to me, if you want to find what you're looking for, go through your notes and look between the lines. And right. At the time, I didn't know what she meant. So I thought, well, she gave me quite a good reading, because she knew I was looking for something. Gold, something out in the box or whatever it is in the desert. She picked up these numbers, so I thought, poor girl, maybe she needs the money, so I gave her another $30, and off she went. But that night, I woke up in the middle of the night, I couldn't sleep because I thought something between the lines, and I realised what she could have meant. So I ran into the room where I got all my books, and I picked up this atlas where I had all these crosses and all this stuff what I did years ago, when I was in America, and I realized what she meant. I went to the place where I did the crosses and the circle. Although it wasn't a small cross and circle, it took up probably about an inch on the page over on this map of Egypt, and I realized if I've got to find anything, the lines would be coordinates lines. You know, the coordinates line, north, south, east, and west. Stuff like that. You know what a coordinates line is, don't you?
Yes.
So I thought it must be a coordinates line, and I picked up some sort of coordinates of where this place could be. About a month later, my wife was listening to our local radio station in English. Our Spanish wasn't that good even now. And she heard of a woman who was called Joyce Morgan, who apparently was a psychic artist. Mm-hmm. And what this woman did, so on the radio, she was explaining, but my wife heard it, I didn't hear about it. She explained that she does a drawing of someone, either a friend or relative who passed away, and then she'd give a reading, and the drawing would be accurate. Apparently this woman was quite renowned. She was on television in Spain, and she went on all the radio stations, and she was quite famous at doing this. She, She was in her late 60s or early 70s. So my wife said, why don't you contact her? Because you haven't done any of this writing anymore. And maybe she can give you some ideas. We have plenty of free time now. We're in Spain. And I was more or less retired, or had retired. And she may tell you something about automatic writing. So I got phoned up the radio station, got a phone number from this woman, Joyce Morgan. I found out she was from Wales, which is in the western part of England, and she'd been living over in Spain for quite a number of years with her husband, who was apparently a healer, faith healer. And she said to us, all I said to her was, Joyce, I've contacted you because I need to know something about automatic writing. And she stopped me. She says, you have to come to see me. I says, yeah, I will do, but what about the automatic writing? She says, don't worry about that. I want you to see me. Can you come over tomorrow? And I thought, hello, this is a good way of getting people to do a reading and get some money out. I said to her, no, Joyce, I can't come to you tomorrow. I says, I'm busy. I said, but where do you live? And she gave me a place about 100 miles from where we live, and it was near our airport in Spain where I normally pick up friends and relatives who come to stay with us. And I said to Joyce, first of all, you live a long way away from us. And what do you charge? And she said, no, I don't charge anything to you because I have to do this. This is something I have to do. You have to come here. Come tomorrow. I said, no, Joyce, can't come tomorrow. The only time I can probably come is when I go and pick someone up at the airport and then I come and call you. No, she says, very adamant, you're coming tomorrow. I said, no, Joyce, and I hung up. 2 minutes later, my phone rang, and it was my insurance agent for my car. And he says, your policy's now ready, and we needed what we call a green card. It's not an American green card. It's a green paper where you can go out the country, because to go across to Gibraltar, you have to go through customs, and I needed this. I said, well, can I come and pick it up at your office? He said, no, it's not in my office, but the main office will post it on to you. I said, I need it immediately. He said, well, then you'd have to go to the office. I said, where is it? He says, near the airport, which was round the corner or in the area where this Joyce Morgan lived. So I hung up, got the address, and called Joyce Morgan, and I heard her chuckling the other end of the phone. She says, I told you you were going to come and see me tomorrow, didn't I? And I thought, wow, how the hell did she know that? Anyhow, the next day, we found her. She had a place called Serendipity, she called it, and it was a spiritual center where she did a lot of talks and lectures, and she had people visiting in there, and it was a place where she took in strayed animals and people who were out of work. She'd find them work and do things for them and everything else, even put them up. And my wife and I got there, and she said, I'd like my wife to go in first for a reading, had a cup of tea first. She still didn't know anything about me. And after about 10 minutes, my wife came out clutching a bit of paper. She had a drawing of a girl or woman who was Chinese, wearing Chinese, but she said she couldn't make out who she was. But Joyce did give her a good reading, and Joyce said to her that when she gets home, she'll realize who the woman is, and she died. So then Joyce said, you come in because I'm next. When I went into the room with her, she said, this has to be recorded. In fact, I've got the recording here now. She says, I have to record what we're going to do because you will need this for later on. I says, fine. Yeah. We sat down, and she closed her eyes, and again, like Giovanna, she started saying, mumbling to herself, numbers, 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 numbers. She says, I can visualize 3, 6, and 9 floating around me. And I thought, wow, here we go again. I says, well, what is it? She says, I don't know, but they're powerful numbers, and I don't know what they mean. They may mean something to me, but not to her, but these are special numbers. Then she turned around and says, I think you're looking for something in the desert. It's some sort of a box. She says, can I draw it for you? I said, yeah, do whatever you want. And she drew a box which was resembled similar to what the Ark of the Covenant could be. It had the four poles on it and the two poles, one either side. It had the top on it like a mercy seat and some figures on top. It didn't look anything to me, really, as the pictures I've seen of the art, but it was, must have been her impression. And I says, what is it, Joyce? She says, I don't know. I said, well, to me that looks like the Ark of the Covenant. And she says, what is the Ark of the Covenant? I says, well, don't you read the scriptures? She says, no, she's never read scriptures. She's not into any biblical stuff or anything like that. But then I told her it's a box. She says, well, this is what you're going to find in the desert. I says, well, what's it made of? She says, gold. I said, oh, wood. But you're going to find this in the desert. And then she went on, she says, is your father's name Jack? And I says, yes. I says, he died. She says, I know. And then she told me my mother's name, who died. No, she hadn't done much. She told my mother's name at the time, she didn't die. And then she told me my grandparents and where they come from. Then she says, you have a cousin living in South America, which blew my mind because I did have a cousin there. And she says she's living alone and she's quite ill. And she was ill because she had to have her two legs amputated. And I thought to myself, how does this woman pick all this up? But what really startled me was she said to me, you have a relative in Hong Kong very close to you. And I thought to myself, well, my wife's Chinese. I must have plenty of relatives over there. Oh, she says, yeah. No, it's not your wife. It's nothing to do with your wife. She says, it's you. She says, you've got either an uncle or a cousin. And then she stopped and closed her eyes. And she said to me, do I have a brother living in Hong Kong? And I nearly fell off my chair because my brother had just been posted to Hong Kong to do lectures. And how she picked that up, I don't know. But what I feel is, if a psychic can tell you about your past so accurately, then if they talk about their future, then they've got to be more or less in tune with it to do it. So anything in the future could have been right. And she's come up with all this stuff with it, looking for the box, gold box, and that was the art, whatever it was. She said, I'm going to draw your spirit guide. I says, spirit guide? She says, yes, you have a spirit guide. And I'm going to draw it. And one, two, three, she drew a guy that looked like a biblical character. I believe you looked at some of these pictures, didn't you?
Did you see these pictures? I saw them on the web, yes.
Yeah, because I'll talk about the web. People can go and look at it later on and see all this thing. Because, you know, without to describe these things, and we haven't got television, you're talking blind audience, you can't see anything. So if you, and actually I wanted you to see it first so you can more or less relate that these things I'm talking about there. And she drew this guy, and he had a big forked beard with massive hair. And I said, well, how will I know this is my spirit guide? He looks more like a biblical character to me. She says, well, when you get home, you will realize this is your spirit guide. And I said, has he got a name? She says, well, he's got a funny name, but I know it's the letter M. Mm. And by the way, I'm thinking of this guy, Moses, who come through to me, whether this is reading my mind or what, I don't know. But I said to her, well, have you got the name? She said, it's a funny name, but I know it's with an M, with an M. And I called out a few names. I said, Moses? She says, no. I said, Musik, Masik, just something like that. So obviously she picked it up. But she said to me, that I want you to come and visit me again because I've got to do some more work on you. So we did the tape recording, which I've got. When we got home, my wife went in. I was in the kitchen making some tea, and she went into the bedroom, come out clutching a photograph of a friend of hers wearing a Chinese dress. And she said, look, this is the same picture as what this Joyce had drawn. I said, but who is it? She's an old school friend of mine. But she says, she wouldn't be dead. She can't be that old. I says, well, does anybody know her? She says, well, we can't call Hong Kong because of time difference. But she knew she had a relative in England, and we made a call to England there and then. And my wife came off the phone looking a bit white. She says, you'll never believe this, but a friend of hers, who this Joyce had drawn, died 4 years ago. So that was really amazing. I mean, this woman, Joyce, was certainly well-renowned, especially to us. Anyhow, we studied the picture of this drawing she did of this guy with a big beard, V-shaped beard, And we noticed that in his right eye, what really got me, I thought anything going to be, it won't be on his body, it would be something in his eye. If it's going to be anywhere, I mean, when you take a picture or draw someone, you're going to see something in their eye of some sort. And yeah. In the iris of the eye was, and you saw it as well, a map that looks like of the Sinai where the Ark of the Covenant was. So that more or less convinced me that this certainly, especially given the name, it was 80% or 60% could have been my spirit guide. Anyway, we went to see Joyce a few times, and by then I was doing channeling. I started doing channeling, and this guy, Moses, came through quite a few times saying that he'd stolen the Ark of the Covenant and he took it to Egypt, and I couldn't get any more out of him than that, or they couldn't get any more. We wrote all this down. In fact, when we were in America, I just have to mention that when I did some more this automatic writing through this guy, Moses, we had a piece of paper, and I've got the paper here now so anybody could DNA the paper and analyse when the writing was done. It was done in 1991. He'd channeled out that there'd be a peace treaty signed by the PLO and Israel in a place called Oslo, which didn't mean anything to me whatsoever. But 2 years later, it actually happened. There was a peace treaty with the PLO in Oslo. So we had that information 2 years before it happened. Wow. Anyhow, when we went to Joyce, she said one day that I'm going to talk about where you're going to find this box. She says it's in a cave in Egypt, and I've got an impression of what that cave looked like. So she quickly drew a sketch, and it was a sketch of a freestanding cave. And I said to Joyce, I says, caves aren't freestanding, they're normally in the side of a mountain. Oh, she says, no, this is freestanding. She got after she finished drawing this cave, she got a pen and made like a half circle over the top. She says, more like a igloo standing just in the middle of the desert. She says, but the reason why it's freestanding is because the cave was in a mountainside, but either earthquakes and different things that happened, it's deteriorated through the wind and rain and whatever happened, and it's now very small. And the cave was probably much larger years ago. She says, but I'm going to give you five landmarks. One landmark is going to be, of course, it's a freestanding cave. The cave is going to have all skeleton bones around it. When you find it, you're going to find skeleton bones. She says, I don't know whether they're human or animal, but that would be one of the landmarks of skeleton bones. The other landmark would be that behind the cave, and you can see in the drawing she showed me, and your people can take a look at it afterwards. Behind the cave is going to be a flat-top pyramid-shaped mountain. That's another landmark you're going to find. So if you find those landmarks, you know you've got the cave. But in front of the cave, you're going to have a dried-up river. And the cave's going to have a back entrance and a front entrance. They're going to be sand-filled. And next to the cave is going to be a huge tree in the shape of a rock. And I thought to myself, if I can find a cave with one of those landmarks, then you're 100% right, because this girl's never been to Egypt or wouldn't know what she was doing, what she drew, anything. And the landmarks, how she got them, I don't know. But she gave us all the landmarks, and I thought, now I've got to go from there. About a month later, I'm walking my dog. I've got a couple of dogs and a cat, but I'm walking one of the dogs up our hill where we live in Spain, and one of our neighbours, I'm passing by, and naturally I haven't told anybody what I was doing or anything, so they think I'm crazy, and he was telling me that his daughter just arrived from England, and I said, I'd like to meet her. He says, well, you better not listen to too much what she talks, because she's a little bit weird, although she's my daughter, but she's always talking about spirits and things like this and everything else, and she comes up with a lot of stuff that doesn't mean anything to me, and she's very weird, so if she talks to you, don't take any notice of what she says. And the girl came out, her name was Dawn, she must have been about 29, 32, something like that, and she says, can I come and walk with you with the dog? I said, yeah, please do, you know, come walk with me. As we're walking, she blurted out, do you know anything about King Solomon's temple? And I says, no, what about King Solomon's temple? She says, well, you're looking for something that was in there. And I says, what is King Solomon's temple? She says, I don't know. She says, these words just come to me. And she said, I'm going back home now because I've got to do some drawings. Can I come and see you tomorrow? I said, yeah. I thought she was a bit weird, but she's come up with King Solomon's temple. And then I realized the Ark of the Covenant was in King Solomon's temple. How did she pick that up? Anyway, the following day she comes into, knocks on the door, holding two pieces of paper. She says, I've got a drawing of something you're going to find. And lo and behold, she'd drawn what looked like the Ark of the Covenant. And with the cherubs on top and everything else. I says, what is it? She says, I don't know. I said, well, this is the Ark of the Covenant. She says, what's the Ark of the Covenant? And I explained what it was. I said, well, didn't you read the Bible or know anything? No, she says, I left school when I was 11 and a half because my mother died and I had to look after my brothers and sisters. So I had no education whatsoever. And all the concentration was on all this weirdo stuff that everybody thought she was doing. The other drawing she gave me, she said, is my spirit guide. And I looked at it, and it was the same drawing as Joyce had drawn. But her impression of the spirit guide was nowhere as clear and as good as Joyce had drawn, because she was an amateur artist, this girl, and she just sketched something, but instead of having all white hair, it was all black hair. And when I looked in the right eye, again, I could see, believe it or not, well, you know, because you've seen it, but this is to your listeners, in the right eye was another drawing of the Sinai Peninsula. And you saw all this, so you know what I'm talking about. It's amazing how it all come out. Anyhow, Joyce told me that we're going to go to Israel, because we're going to find a special map in Israel when we go on holiday. And I said, Joyce, we can't go to Israel. We haven't got much money because I lost it all. When we came to America, I invested a lot in a bank that went bust and we lost all our money. And we're just living on a pension at the moment. And I said, no, Joyce. I said, we can't afford to go. She says, yes, you will go. Don't worry. You'll be going to Israel. You're going to find a map. And a few weeks later, my mother died. And my house got flooded. We had a guy, our neighbour, was going to look after the dogs. And the water tap went on. And when we got home, we found all our carpets, and they were quite expensive carpets, Persian carpets, all got flooded. Yeah. And the insurance company says, you can't get paid out because you didn't describe these pieces. And I forgot about it. And 2 weeks later, we get a cheque for £4,000. And I called the agent. I said, wow, I thought we weren't insured for this. He said, I don't know why you got the check, but you've got it. And just keep quiet and just accept it. I thought, well, good idea. We've got some money to go to Israel. I've never been there. I wanted to see the Holy Land and stuff like that there. So we went off to Israel. And when we went to Israel, we went on a tour. And the guy who was doing the tour said to my wife and I, would we like to go down to Mount Sinai, which was not on our itinerary? I said, well, it's not on our itinerary, and we don't want to pay any extra money. He says, no. She says, I've got two people that just cancelled, and they were ill, and they had to go back to England, and you can have a free trip. I said, well, free, we don't mind. So off we went to the Sinai, which is where supposed Mount Sinai and St. Catherine's. It took us about 4 hours drive through the desert. We had to go in two vehicles in case one broke down, because the roads weren't all that good. There was no traffic on the roads at the way. And if one broke down, there was not much one could do unless you've got another vehicle to help you. Luckily, we did have a problem. Anyhow, we got down to this Mount Sinai. He said, we're going to go up to the mountain, not to the top, but we're going to go up. There's some stone steps which are hewn out for the last few hundred years, and it's there where we can go up and see a beautiful sunset. And then the following day we're going to go to this St. Catherine's Monastery. Have you heard of St. Catherine's Monastery?
No, only from you.
Oh, okay. The St. Catherine's Monastery was built in about the year 300 or 400 AD. It was built by the early Christians, and apparently the Greek monks a great Christian that I've used place ever since. Anyhow, as we're walking up, it was a bit of a hike, and my wife says, no, she doesn't want to go up. So there's a kiosk there where they're serving soft drinks in like a tent with the arrows or something. And she stayed there with one of the guys, and the other guy started to go up the mountain, and I started going up, and I said to him, no, I don't fancy going up. I don't want to see a sunset. There's nothing interests me. I'll stay here and pick me up on your way back. And she did. She went up the mountain with the rest of us, about 10 of us in the cruise. The other 9 went up with this guy. And I just stood there with my camera. And I turned round, and below me was a valley at the bottom of this hill, mountain, whatever you call it. And I was like hypnotized to it. So I took a few photographs. At the time, I didn't know what was down there, but I just took some pictures. In those days, all we had was the old 35mm camera, not the digital. You couldn't see what you'd taken anyway. And something made me stand up and recite out loud the Ten Commandments, as best as I knew them, because I didn't know them that well, but I know most of the commandments and what they were. And when I called them out, I realized that if Moses had been up that mountain or any other mountain, how the thousands of people, Israelites or whatever they were, would have heard him call the Ten Commandments out, because there were no microphones or speakers in those days, and how would his voice be heard? But when I called out the Ten Commandments, it echoed throughout all the mountaintops, and you could really hear it coming back to me. As loud as it was, but it boomed back, and I was a bit shaken hearing my voice boom back as I called it everywhere else. And with that, my wife came over, and she walked up to want to know what all this racket was going on up here with this Arab guide, Egyptian guide. And I said to him, I said, this is a very special place. I said, I feel it's very spiritual. He says, yes, the Bedouins. You know what the Bedouins are, don't you? The tribe of Bedouins.
The nomads, aren't they?
Yeah. He says, they always gather here at a certain time of the year, and they see a lot of visions down in the valley, and they keep it all to themselves. He says, it's quite a spiritual place. What made me think that? I said, I don't know. But when we got, as we're leaving, we got back to, we slept in tents that night, actually, and the next day we went to the monastery. When we got to the monastery, the guide says, they can't come in because it belongs to the monks, but we can go in there for about an hour and a half, look around, don't talk to the monks, because none of them speak English, they're all Greek, and just look around, see whatever they've got in there, and come out, and we're leaving about an hour and a half's time at your own leisure. So in we went, and for some reason or other, I walked over to one of the monks, and he spoke perfect English, and I says, I'm sorry, I didn't realise you could, I didn't think you could speak English. He says, yes, I'm the only one who speaks English here. He says, why have you approached me? I said, I don't know why, I feel I have to talk to you. And I give him a very quick, because we never had much time, talking about the Ark of the Covenant. And when I started bringing up the subject, he says to me, I want you to come with me to a very special place in the monastery, which is forbidden for the tourists to go to. No tourists go there, but it's their spiritual center where they do all their heavy praying and stuff like that there. And I said, why am I going to go? She says, I just feel you should come with us. So we went down there, and when his back was turned, I actually sneaked up a couple of pictures. I didn't know what I was taking. I just took some pictures. And then he took afterwards up to the library. Now, the library there is one of the oldest libraries in the world. There's two ancient libraries. One's in the Vatican, and one is in this actual monastery. Right. And it's a big, musty room upstairs in one of the lofts where no tourists go. And he let us look around in there. When he was out, he said, I'm going to see if I can organise some tea for you to make and go into one of the offices. But look around, don't take any books off the shelf or open them or anything like that, but just look around and see if you can understand them. They're all in foreign languages anyway. But in one of the glass cases was a huge book opened up, must have been a very old one, and opened to a page where it was of Moses walking down the mountain with the commandments, and there in front of him was the Ark of the Covenant. And I thought that was quite interesting. And then he took us into an office, gave us tea, and then we had to leave. When we left, the guide, who I've now spoken to him about the Ark and bits and things, he says to me, I'm going to stop on the way back to Israel. It's about a mile away from where we are now. I'm going to show you something interesting. And he stopped the vehicle, and he showed us a mountainside where there was a huge cutout, a sculpture of a calf. And it was about 40 foot long, huge in the mountain. It was raining, but we couldn't stay there too long. I took a quick picture of it, and apparently my mind went back to the story of Moses when they actually prayed to this golden calf. And this could have been something to do with it, I don't know. But when I checked it all out later, apparently no archaeologist or anyone has ever looked or examined this thing. And I think they should go out there and check to see if they can dig up and find something about it, because obviously it was done hundreds or maybe a thousand years ago, I don't know. But we got back to Israel, very briefly. When you go into these places of interest, like museums and that, there's always little big bookshops selling books. And we went into one place which was a museum. It didn't mean anything to me. It was actually a museum of the president of Israel who died, the first president, called Weizmann. And I thought to myself, quicker we get out of here, the better, because it didn't interest me whatsoever. And everyone's looking in this bookshop, and something made me go to behind the counter into a room at the back. And on the back was a huge, it was a dimly lit room. There was a big picture of a book with a map on it. And I said to the guy who's selling all the stuff, I said, I'd like to buy that. He says, you can't, because everything here has been documented, but we don't know where that come from. We put a number on it, but no one knows who gave us it or where it come from or anything else. I said, well, can I take a quick picture of it? He says, yes. So I went outside, took a quick photo of it, but it came out, but not that brilliant, because it was on glass. And of course, without a digital camera, you don't know what you're doing. And the reflection blurred it a bit, but when we got home back to Spain, we found it was a map of the Exodus. So it was quite interesting map, a good picture. Anyhow, when we were in actually Israel, we met some before that in Gibraltar where we live, who was from Israel. And they said, if you ever go to Israel, you should meet a psychic woman who does a lot of psychic work. She comes from South Africa, but she's been living in Israel many years. And when you go there, contact us, and maybe we can get you an interview with her. And which I did. And we went to see this woman. She knew about the Ark, and she knew what I was doing. And when we visited her, she said, I'm going to give you lunch, but before I do that, I want to put you into meditation, and I have to record all this. Again, someone who wanted to record, I've got the recording here. She's put me in, laid me down on a sort of a bed or whatever it was, and above me was a huge crystal. Never forget this, a big crystal was there. And after a minute or so, I must have gone off to sleep into a trance and started talking. But this woman, whose name was Menorah, her name was actually Menorah Charlie, she went into trance the same time as I did, and she started talking about the mosaic. There is a mosaic, it is true, the Ark is there, Jerry's got to find it, this, that, the other, and I come up with this tree, a special tree I'm going to pass by on the way in the desert when I'm out there and everything else. So everything seemed to work out good. Anyhow, we got back to Spain, and I found out that the photographs I took of all our trip to Israel, all the pictures come out perfect, even those that we took in the monastery. But the three or four pictures I took on this roll of film, 35mm film, what I took in the holy place, believe it or not, were blank. They were just blacked out, and I've got no idea why, because there was enough light out there to take pictures, even though it was a 35mm camera. I didn't use flash, but they should have come. I should have had something on, but there was nothing on it, completely blank. It was as though I wasn't allowed to take pictures in that sacred place. Anyhow, when we got back, I said to them, after a few months, I said, well, let's have another trip. I've never been over to Egypt. Well, perhaps I say never been over. The only time I was in Egypt was when I did 2 years national service in the army, where I was subscribed, subscription into the army. And I spent a year in the canal zone, which apparently is the area where the Exodus crossed somewhere near where the Suez Canal is now. It wasn't there, naturally, it wasn't built years ago, but apparently that's where the Sea of Reeds were. The whole place, it was called the Bitter Lakes, which was part of the Red Sea, which was described in the Bible. And this must have been a reeded area years ago where springs or waters, and that's where they crossed. They wouldn't have crossed down to Mount Sinai at the bottom. I believe that Mount Sinai is in the top, but that's another story. Mm. And we went over there. I thought, well, let's go to Egypt for a holiday. And we spent a weekend on the Nile on a cruise. And the other week we spent in Cairo. But when we were living in Spain, we met another... I'll just go back a little bit because I've just got this part. We met another woman who was quite psychic. In fact, she was a dowser. And without knowing what I knew or anything about me, I just said to her, here's a big map. Do you know what the Ark of the Covenant is? She says, yes. I said, her name was Mallory. She was an American woman in her early 70s. And I says, do you reckon you can map down? She says, I'll try anyway. And I had a huge, by then I had bought up myself a huge map, one of these ordnance maps, which is about 4 foot square, big one. And I put that on the table and I says, where do you think the Ark is? And she got her hand and below, I just couldn't believe it. Palm of the hand went smack on the area where on my map was this cross and all that. She picked up the same place. And at the time, she said, my hand's getting very, very hot. And this is definitely the place. And she said to me, you should meet some people. And she put me in touch with a guy called Robert Bovell. You heard of Robert Bovell?
Yes, yes. He's written some very good books on his own archaeology, yes.
Yeah, he wrote a book with a guy called Adrian Gilbert on their theory of the three pyramids tied up with the Orion belt, the stars and that.
Yes,
and I got friendly with Robert Bovell because he was interested in my work, invited me to his home in England, in the country he was living, in the West Country, and invited me to a few of his meetings and everything else. But he says, who I should talk to is a guy who did a lot of work with the Edgar Cayce Foundation, the ARE. You heard of Edgar Cayce, haven't you?
Absolutely, yes, yes.
You know that.
Wonderful books.
Yeah. Well, he put me in touch with a guy called Joseph Shaw, who was a multimillionaire, and he invited me over to meet him in America. We went, my wife and I went to New York to meet him. And he even, we spoke about the pyramids, and I told him that there might be a chamber underneath the Queen's chamber, hidden chamber there, and he wanted to know how I found that out. I just said, I feel there's one there. He says, we're actually working on that at the moment. So he was surprised that I knew about it, because to him it was apparently secret what they were doing. He says, I have to do my project first, and then I'll help you do the Ark of the Covenant. He sent me a letter about all this, so that was right. At that time, I was friendly with a guy called Boris Said, and he put me in touch with a guy called J.J. Hertak. Have you heard of J.J. Hertak?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I have.
He wrote The Keys of Enoch. And yes. I said to this guy, Boris Said, I said, I'm trying, if you know this guy Hertak, I'd like to talk to him, you know, tell him the stuff I'll be there for. Apparently, he's quite an important person and done a lot of work, psychic work and everything, especially with Egypt. And he says, well, by the way, he's in America at the moment. I says, well, in New York. I says, well, can I get hold of him? He says, he won't talk to you. He's so busy. He hasn't got time to talk to anybody. I'll pass the message on. I says, well, just do this for me, please. Phone him up now while I'm here, because I'm going back to Spain tomorrow. And just give him a number of 142-857, that special number. And I said to him, when you give him this number, it might react. And he called him, gave him the number 142-857, and he said, I'm coming over immediately. Don't leave where I am now, because he has to see me. And this guy, Boris, says, well, He says, I've never known this happen before. And about half an hour, a taxi must have pulled up outside, I don't know, because he didn't have a car. And he came up and he says, where did you find this number? And I said, well, I did it by working out the number from God, the creation, took 7 days. He said, well, he's been looking for this number for many, many years. And it, only recently he found it in the book of Revelations. And he was surprised what I did. And then I've spoken about the ark. And he was quite a spiritual man, this guy. And even he says that it looks like I'm going to find the Ark of the Covenant. And I should continue with my work and carry on with it. So everything looked good.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, when we went to Egypt, I wanted to go and see the Great Pyramid. And I didn't realize that you've got to buy a ticket early in the morning because only a few people allowed in there.
So yeah, Jerry?
Yes.
Well, when you went back to Egypt, what year was that?
This was about 2003.
Oh, right. Okay. Just wanted to put a time on it so that it has a bit more reality. Yes, so you went off for your ticket.
It was 2003. I think we went to Israel 2002 or before that.
Right.
Of course, we went over to Spain in 1992. So it was about okay. 10 years later. So we went off to see this great, but I went off to see the Great Pyramid. My wife was tired. She should see the pyramid. She wouldn't want to go inside anyway. She went back to the hotel. And, when I went up to the entrance, it's an enormous, there's 2.2 million blocks over near enough that is the size of the pyramid. Did you know there's that amount of blocks in there? 2.2 million?
Fantastic.
And each of those blocks, some of those blocks weigh 30 and 60 ton each.
Mm.
And nobody knows how they were built because between each one of those blocks, the joints were paper thin. You could put a piece, it's the size of a paper. And a lot of people have been saying that these blocks could have been levitated. But I thought to myself, if they had to be levitated, where did they get the blocks from? Where were those huge blocks cut up and put into the pyramid? 2.2 million is a hell of a big number. And surely, where would they get those blocks? Where would they be quarried? If they were quarried somewhere, it would have to be enormous quarries, more or less a mountain size, and they'd have to be taken to Egypt, to Cairo, to the Giza Plateau, where it all is. And then something dawned on me. I thought to myself, wow. Now I know why I met that scientist, the Mormon scientist, who says he can make pipelines in the sand as strong and look like rock. And I realized that the only way, I believe, and it's feasible because somebody else came up with his idea later on, a professor called David Dovitz, actually his name, Joseph David Dovitz, and he's a Frenchman. Someone can look him up on the internet. But what happened was, if they could produce, if there was enough sand around, presumably in those days, it was desert, and if they would have built a huge mold, we're talking about giant-sized mold, and then poured the sand in, which was freely available, put in a mixture, then it would look exactly like a rock and weigh the size of a rock. And they could then put another one on top of it and do the same thing, and the actual mould would burn itself out, so it would be a paper-thin join. And this is the way they could have created these huge gigantic blocks and built the pyramid.
Right.
It's a method. Anyhow, it's my theory, and I say that this other guy, David Ovitz, professor, he came up with the same thing.
Right, yeah.
So that's an idea. Anyhow. They wouldn't let me in the Great Pyramid. He says, you need a permit anyway. I said, well, where do I get that from? He says, the only one I can give you that is Dr. Hawass. You heard of Dr. Zia Hawass? He's the archaeologist who did all the work out there. And he says, you'll have to go to the offices, which are nearby, but apparently you won't be able to see Dr. Hawass because he's in America. So he gave me one of his guides who guided us to where the offices were. It was around the back of the Great Pyramid. It's a block, a low-lying block of two buildings, and I went into one of them, and there was a guy sitting on a desk with a lot of people in there, and I introduced myself, and he said, no, he said, I can't give you a permit, and he's Dr. Hawass, and Dr. Hawass is not back yet, and everything else, and I started talking to these guys, and they gave me tea, and after about 20 minutes, in comes an Egyptian, talking away in Arabic, and apparently Dr. Hawass had just arrived. It was amazing that I got there the day he arrived. I said, I'd like to see him. And they went in there and they said, well, he'll see you in about 10 minutes because he just arrived. I went in to see Dr. Hawass, and on this hat rack, I realized it was Dr. Hawass because it had his special hat that he always wears, like one of these bush hats. Yeah. In there was Dr. Hawass. And I got friendly with him quite quickly. And I got permission to go into, well, first of all, he says, who are you? And I told him, he said, I don't know. I said, well, I know this Joseph Shaw, and he was going to help me in a project. He says, yes, I know Joseph Shaw. He comes over here quite a lot, and he's been working with me. Apparently, must have given him a lot of money to do a lot of things over there. And he says, if you're a friend of Joseph Shaw's, he says, why not? I'll let you go in there. He says, the Queen's Chamber is closed to tourists, but you can go in there. You're allowed to go in there. So I went in there about after it all closed, the whole building, the whole pyramid's closed, 1 o'clock, it's everything closes half day. And they gave me another guy to take me in there, a guy named Mohammed. He spoke English. And we went in there, and I went into the Queen's Chamber. I had to climb down these, probably a lot of your listeners know that you have to climb down the shafts, whether they've been to the King's Chamber, but the Queen's Chamber further down, they didn't want people in there at that time because they were doing some work in there, plus it was a long way to go and it was a smaller area. And I went in with this guy, and I took out a compass, had a compass with me, and I found the north wall of the actual tomb, the chamber, and I put my hands my two hands above my head, leaned against the wall, closed my eyes, trying to do some meditation, and I felt my whole body gliding and moving into the wall, and I got a bit scared. And I said to Mohammed, who was with me, I said, Mohammed, I says, can you do what I did? Just close your eyes and put your hands on here and see what happens. And he did the same. And he pushed himself away and he got frightened. He says, let's get out of here. He says, I don't like this. I'm nervous. And we went out. And we got out, and I started meeting a lot of the, back in the office, I stayed with them for the afternoon, talking to them. In fact, I've shown them a lot of card magic and tricks like this there, and I got really friendly with all of them. In fact, I said to one of the guys that his wife's going to have a baby, and he said, no, my wife can't have a baby. We've been trying for years. I said, well, she's going to have a baby girl, and apparently later on she did have a baby girl, and after that I was quite well known over to the Egyptian authorities. And when we were there, a guy called Mansour Borak, B-O-R-A-I-K, and Mansour Borak later was investigating the Valley of the Golden Mummies. Do you know about those down in the Bahrain Oasis in Egypt? They found thousands of golden mummies and tombs.
The first person I heard it from was you, Jerry. I've never heard of that story before.
Okay, well, let your listeners go on to the, they probably know, or go on to the internet where you can do it. Punch in Valley of Golden Mummies, and you'll find all these thousands of golden mummies that this Borak, well, they found, that they discovered the whole lot down there. And I got quite friendly with him. In fact, he wanted me to do some other work out there. And he said, I'm going to introduce you, because by then the Borak is gone, to the director of the Giza Plateau of the Pyramids. And his name was Adel Mohammed. And I went to meet Adel Mohammed in his office. Because they all told him about me being there, this crazy English guy, whatever it was, and I got permission from Hawass to go in to see the Queen's Chamber there. And I got friendly with him, and apparently he had a problem with his arm. He couldn't lift it higher than eye level. And I did some spiritual healing. I won't go into what I did, but within about half a minute, he could raise his hand right to the ceiling. It was amazing. Even I was more amazed than he was, but he was quite
wonderful.
Late. And he told his secretary in English, she could speak English, he said, I've been to many doctors, they couldn't cure me. He says, I thought I'd have this the rest of my life, and Jerry's done it there and then. And I said, I want to show you some pictures that I've done, but they're in the hotel room. He said, well, use my vehicle, take my chauffeur, he'll drive you there, because I got real friendly with him. And we did that. And he really helped me, and I got to know a lot of people. Anyhow, when we got back to Spain, I thought I'd better start investigating more about Egypt. Now I've got the feel of going back to Egypt. Maybe I should go without my wife and try and find this cave, but I didn't want to do it alone. Mm. And I thought to myself, if this big mountain is somewhere, there might be a picture of it. And I've checked it. By then, the internet was going well with me. I could know how to use it. And I looked on the internet. I found some pictures of a mountain where some guys... What do? They go to coordinates. It's like people going to the moon. The first guy that got to this to the moon put a flag in there. What they do, they go to a coordinate of maybe 25 by 25. They get to this coordinates, stick a pole there and put their name on it and say, I'm not the first one, I'm the first one to be there for this club or whatever it was, and then to take pictures. Well, he came up with an area where I did my coordinates. I can't go into the number, but he did it. And I thought to myself, he's got a picture of looked like a big mountain, pyramid-shaped mountain. I thought, this is interesting. I contacted the guy. He said, well, to get out there, you've got to go into the desert. You need four-wheel drive. I can't give you directions, but I can tell you roughly where it is and where you've got to get to and stuff like that. But he passed a lot of monks living in caves, and you've got to go past these monks and when you're there, you know you're on the right road. And I thought, well, I can't go on myself. At first, I couldn't drive in the desert. About driving cars like a madhouse. To drive in the desert where there's no roads, nothing at all except big sand dunes. And we went out there, and I found some other guys in England who wanted to go with me, and there was five of us went out there. We eventually got to this monk's cave. I won't go too long because I don't know how long we've got now, because I'm going to speed this up a bit. And we couldn't, we got about 15 kilometers away from this. In fact, the monks there told us that they knew there was something spiritual out in the desert, but they didn't know what, and they couldn't get out there because they walked out that far and they wouldn't go out of their perimeter of their caves. They lived in caves and they had all their churches and their places of worship and everything else. I mean, they were just monks, Coptic monks, actually. Coptic, the early Christians of Egypt. And they're still there, the Coptics. Anyhow, we went out, and when we got there, we went in two vehicles, and there was a sandstorm. And we couldn't get to this place, but we had to go back to Cairo, and we had to get flights back and everything else. We made a pact that we'd go out there the following year. But I found out that 2 months later, two of the guys, one was Canadian, one was an English guy, went behind my back and went to try to get out there again to find this cave and to find the mountain. But apparently they couldn't. Since then, one of the guys had died, and the other guy's gone on another path. And like, he went actually two or three times, he couldn't find anything or do anything. Apparently he wasn't meant to. Because Joyce Morgan also told me that when the cave is found, there's only going to be one other person with me. And this time there was five, so we couldn't find it. Next time I went out there was with the guy who introduced me to this Mormon scientist, American guy. I got friendly with him, and I said to him, you did help me get all this stuff done. I contacted him. I said, get yourself an air flight, come over to Egypt, we're going to look for this Ark of the Covenant cave and stuff like that there. And I went out with him, with my driver, Egyptian driver. We found a driver who knew the deserts well. And we went out, we couldn't find not one cave. So I went out there three times and we couldn't find any caves whatsoever. The next time I went, in fact, it's the last time I went, I went out just with my driver. And I said to the Egyptian driver, his name was Abdul, Yeah, it's amazing. I met him, but it's all on my website. When you go to my website, which I give it out before we go, so they can read more about this, because I'm only telling you a little bit, and what's on the website is only a little bit. And I'm writing a book of about 500 pages, but we're trying to now get edited and get published, so that should be out soon. Anyhow, I went out along with this guy, and we looked around for about 2 weeks. We couldn't find any cave or anything that looked like a cave. So it was just a waste of time. But what we did find, we found a mountain or a huge mound in the shape of the Sphinx. It not only looked like the Sphinx, it was well weathered, but it was the size of the Sphinx, and it faced it east, the same as the Sphinx. And I took a photograph of it, and even the Egyptians don't even know it's there. I've got to get that examined later on. But when we're out, I said to him, look, I says, Abdul, I says, I've wasted 20 years, 18 years looking for this, this golden box, looking for a cave, and I can't find it. I've wasted my life. Take me to this Bahrain oasis where I knew about these golden mummies. I'd like to see that while I'm out there, because it's not that far away. Far away, but we're already out in the desert. And I said, am I going to find the cave? You will. And he laughed. He said, you're joking, Jerry, because we're good English. Quite a good guy, actually. And I fell asleep in the truck. After about what seemed a few minutes, he's waking me up. He says, Jerry, I found the cave, I found the cave. And I woke up, and he's saying, Jerry, I found the cave. I says, no, I says, this is a nightmare. This is a dream. You couldn't have found the cave, man. This is impossible. I says, pinch me. He says, no, look, here's the cave. And I stepped out the vehicle, and lo and behold, was a freestanding cave, sand filled. All around the cave were skeleton bones. Mm. And I said to him, wow. I said, this is the first one I found, or you've found, or we've had to find. I said, let's go back about 500 yards, drive back, because I want to take a movie. By then we had a digital camera. I want to take a movie of the landscape. And we went back about 500 yards, and I put my camera up, took a picture of the landscape, panned from left to right, as one does when you do the panning. And lo and behold, the scenery was all flat-top hills. But when I got to the cave, I stopped, because behind the cave was a pyramid-shaped flat-top mountain. You saw that picture, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. It was amazing. There it was, exactly the landmark where Joyce had told me. Joyce said there'd be skeleton bones. Behind the cave would be freestanding. Behind it would be this pyramid-shaped mountain. And in front of it, there was a lot of signs of some twigs and that. And I asked Abdul, what is this? He says, it was a dried-up river before. So now we got in the other landmark. And he said to me, We can't go back to Cairo tonight. We'll have to camp here. And when we camp here, it's too windy in front of this cave. I'm going to find another place to look. And I started picking up, looking at these bones, trying to examine them and stuff like that there. And he comes back. He says, I found another entrance to the cave, and it's a bit sheltered. We can go back there. So that was another landmark, he told me. It'll have two entrances.
Right.
When we got there, he said, I'm going to sleep in a one-man tent, which he's got with him, and I should sleep in the truck. He said, but we cook a meal, so we're going to make a campfire. I've got some logs, but go and get some brush and some twigs to keep fire scattered around, and we light the fire. And while he was unpacking his truck, the 4x4, I went out, and I'm picking up these bits of twigs and bending down, and I look up, and in front of me, there's a huge tree in the shape of a rock. Again, you saw that picture.
Yeah, so amazing.
All the landmarks, what this woman had told us, plus the fact that there was only one other person with me. So we knew there has to be either the Ark of the Covenant or an ancient copy or something there, because for the woman to draw all this, it was incredible. It was incredible. Absolutely. Because when I got back, and you saw the drawing, her drawing and the picture of the cave were identical. they were split an image as though she knew what I was going to photograph and she'd actually drawn it. It was incredible. Unfortunately, Joyce died a few years ago to live to see all this because it was unfortunate. Anyhow, that night I'm sitting in the truck. I went to sleep in the truck and he's in his little tent. In the middle of the night, he's banging on the window. What the hell's going on in the truck? What's going on in the truck? And he woke me up. I says, what's the matter, Abdel? What is it? He says, there's voices in the truck. I can hear people talking. I says, no one in here except me. He says, no, I heard foreign voices talking. It went on and on and on. He says, it woke me up. I said, no, go back to sleep. It must have been me talking in the sleep. I must have realized I was channeling, and I didn't want to tell him that. Otherwise, he'd run away and think I'm crazy and leave me in the desert. Anyhow, the next morning when I woke up, the whole story unfolded. Apparently, Moses and his men had stolen the ark from Solomon's temple and was taking it to a wealthy landowner who was like a pharaoh of the Bahrain oasis. And when I checked all this out, I found out that the Bahrain oasis, that the guy who was in charge collecting all these antiquities, he reigned exactly the same time when King Solomon's temple was built. Not only that, but he was the high priest of Egypt, and he would have wanted the ark more than any else to put in his own temple. So everything matched, and that was the reason why he wanted it. But Moses was apparently the story unfolded, that his men were conspiring, saying that they should also get part, a big hefty part of this reward, and not just a few dollars or whatever, bits of gold. It was going to be underpaying him. And he thought they were going to kill him, so he killed the poisoned the whole lot. This is the story goes. And when he poisoned them all, the guard who was actually standing there with a spear in front of this ark or whatever it was, he poisoned him, but when, he was a big, strong guy, and he must have known the other guys were going to die, so he speared this Moses, and he died, and everybody died, and the ark is there to this day or whatever is there to this day. And apparently... they all went off to the spirit world, but Moses stayed where he is until the ark is found. And people say, well, why should it be me? Why did this Moses got me? And I said, well, the only way would be is when I was in Egypt in the army, I was living in that, camping in that area, and his spirit might have crossed my path and thought, well, here's a guy who might be want to do this thing, and later on I'm going to do a bit of walking. So possibly this is what happened. Anyhow, there's a roll of the ark. I had a friend named Janet. I don't know how much time we got now. Much time? 10 minutes?
Yeah, or just about, yes. Yes.
Very quickly, I'll go on quickly, otherwise it'll take up too much time. I want to finish the story. Okay. I had a friend named Janet who had helped me a lot, an elderly woman living in Spain. And she's the one who put me in touch with the woman who did the map dowsing and put me in touch with a lot of people. And she knew a guy in England called Douglas Ballard. And apparently he channels Horus. He's quite well known in England. You can look at his website. Anyhow, she said, send him an email. Maybe he can give you some information about the art. And I sent him an email. But he never responded. And a few months later, she said she's going to see him. Do I have any questions? I said, no, I've got no questions because, he didn't answer me and he's not interested. She said, okay. She said, I'm going to see him anyway. And she came back about a week later. She says, I saw Douglas. And Douglas says, please apologize to Jerry. I looked through my junk mail. I just found his email. And I read him as a spot because I didn't have it. But tell Jerry... on the information I'm giving him, he may understand, but he didn't understand, or Janet. He says, just tell him the word wandering. As soon as I heard the word wandering, it dawned on me what the Ark of the Covenant would be. And I thought, if it's all these people have been talking about the Ark, none of them have actually, there's been books written and documentaries and all that, but not one person has said, well, how do they know it's the Ark of the Covenant? Yeah. And to me, I think it has to be radiocarbon dated, just a grain, like a grain of it, more or less as big as a grain of rice from one of the poles, radiocarbon data and find out when that tree fell, and it fell round about 1400 AD or BC, whatever it was, then it's possible to be about 90% the Ark of the Covenant. And if it's found that it's got these special crystals in or whatever's in there, Ten Commandments, or then we'd know it's the Ark of the Covenant. But if it's an ancient coffee, it would be a fantastic find because we'd realise what the real Ark would look like anyway. So yes, that would be one thing. But I had no idea why the Ark would be in the desert until this Moses came up with the story. I mean, I thought, what the hell is it doing out in the desert? And when he hears this word, when I got this word wandering, I thought, well, this is the role of the Ark. When it's found, if it was found 30 years ago, not many people know about the Ark except religious people, but today everybody would want to see it. Of course, it would be naturally on television that the Ark's been found, and it would go to an big auditorium in every capital city in the world. Let's say one of them would be New York. When it goes there, there'd be millions of people flocking in to see it, but there'd be no charge for admission. But a lot of them are going to get some spiritual inclination or whatever it's going to be, or this wonder of seeing it, they could donate. And we're talking of billions of dollars being donated. I mean, billions of people are going, all gave a dollar, some will give less, some will give more, on a regular basis. And this money would go into nothing to do with me. I don't want nothing for this. All my job is to find the Ark. It's to do with helping this planet. The money would be used in a world organization for medical research, for AIDS, cancer, MS, and all diseases to find cures. It would also be used if there's a problem in the world, an earthquake, a tsunami or somewhere where money is needed, medical aid is needed. It would be done for that. It would be done for space research, for global warming, for everything. Where a man in the street wouldn't donate money, it'd be donating something to see the Ark, and this would be it. Now, if the Ark left, say, New York to go on to Los Angeles or London or wherever the next place, they'd make an exact replica of the Ark, including all the gold, the weight and everything else, and they would put in the Ark from the real Ark, if it's found, tablets of stone or crystal to energize the copy, take the good one with them on to other countries, and those who couldn't see the real Ark will want to see the other one, a copy, which was energized, and you'd probably get the same reaction, so there'd be money going in there. Once a year it would go to Israel for the three religions people to take a look at, and anybody else wanted to see it, and they could do their own talk about the God or whatever they're going to talk about, discuss their religions, because the Ark's not only mentioned the Old Testament and the New Testament, it's also mentioned in the Quran, so it belongs to all the religions. Now, at those time, years ago, Jerusalem's temple, as I say, if it meant to be, it would be there to this day, but apparently it didn't, it left. And if it was, when it was there, it was only the people in Israel that could pray and do their things. So if it went to this big auditorium around the world, the three religious groups would have a section where they could talk about their religion and do that and use it as a temple, part of it, where they could face the Ark and see it and do everything. Because the Ark was seen. The only time that the priest in Israel said you can't see the Ark was when it got into Solomon's temple, for the reason why they couldn't see it, because it wasn't there. It disappeared. It was stolen. That they couldn't tell the people there that it was there. So this was the role. And a few days after I found the cave, I met a guy called, not I met, I was introduced, some another psychic way, I won't go into it, so we can finish this off. I met a guy called Dr. Brutus Garley, who was the Ex-Secretary-General of the United Nations. And as soon as he heard what I was doing, he invited me to meet him in his Cairo office, and we discussed the role of the Ark, what we said. He said, it would be a good idea, this, because not only it helped the planet, but if it's found on Egyptian soil, because this guy was also one of the high lawyers in Egypt before he was the Secretary-General. And he said that to get it out of Egypt, it would be good, because if the Egyptians know they're going to get a percentage of these billions of dollars going in, it would be more money than they get from tourism, or more money than they get from the parading round or exhibiting the Tutankhamun. So this would be a method. But it all have to be agreed by nations with all this, because it's nothing. Once it's found, it's found. When we were in Egypt, I'll cut this very quickly because this is the main part. When we were in Egypt, it looks like I discovered the second Sphinx on the Giza Plateau, which I spoke to you about. It's on my website. I've given my website before I finish. And we have to get out to Egypt to find where this ark is or whatever's under the sand there. And the only way we're going to do it is using ground-penetrating radar. That can detect what's under the sand and even tell if it's gold, oblong box or whatever. It won't show us exactly what it is, but it'll give us an idea where, not us, but someone would have to dig. Because I can't do the digging and it would have to be arranged by governments or whatever. If we know it'll have to be publicised. Anyhow, to get this out there, we need a permit. We cannot get a permit, but when I come up with the second Sphinx, I found the second Sphinx on a big mound next to the Sphinx in Egypt. In fact, I haven't told you this, but recently I had a guy who did some dowsing, and without knowing what it was, he told me there's another Sphinx under this mound. So he came up with the same thing. But he says it's not the same size as the Sphinx, it's smaller. And I said, it's an English guy, actually. I'm going to put it on my website later. He's going to do a drawing and write down what he believed. He says the reason why it's smaller is because it's female. And then that really was a bonanza to me because everybody know, or the people who know the Sphinx in Egypt, knows it's a male and not female. Something by the shape of the head. And a male and a female make sense being side by side because all the food dogs, you know, the Chinese food dogs, are all male and female, kings and queens, whatever they will call them. And this makes sense that there's two. So what we're looking for now, what I'm mainly looking for now, is an archaeologist, and hopefully someone's out there who can put one in touch with me. I did find one archaeologist, but we need an archaeologist who will go with his university or some renowned society or some company known to Egypt to get a permit to use ground-penetrating radar to look for the second Sphinx. And when we get the ground-penetrating radar out there legally, we can then go out to the desert and look for the ark. That's the main thing. But hopefully the Sphinx is there at all. So that's what we're looking for. Now, can I get out my website, please?
Absolutely, I want you to. Yes, please.
Right. My website, I'll call it out and then I'll spell it for you.
Yes.
It's jerrysarkquest.com. And that's Jerry with a G. And if you've all got a bit of paper and pencil handy, it's www.g. for George, E. Edward, R. Robert, R. Robert, Y. Yellow, S. Sam, that's Jerry's, and the next word, and it's all one word, ArcQuest, A. Apple, R. Robert, K. King, Q. Queen, U. Uncle, E. Edward, S. Sam, T. Tommy. And if you go to that website, on the bottom of the website, the first page, you're going to see another radio you're going to watch a YouTube of a radio broadcast I did in Canada a few weeks ago. And what the guy did that was very good, in fact, he had to do this so I can get it publicised. He put all these pictures that I've been speaking to about, and a lot of other stuff, because I think it lasted about 2 hours. And he put it all on the YouTube. It's in part one and part two, so you can see all that there. Then if you go to a page, another heading on that page, it says research. And under research, you're going to see a big picture of the pyramids, two pyramids, and the Sphinx. And you're going to see an indication where I put the mound, where another Sphinx would be. And just below that, you're going to see, if you want to read the 14-page story about this with all the photographs, click on that site, click underneath there, and you can read the whole lot from the other guy's site. So what we're looking for is an archaeologist now, so to do the Sphinx so we can get everything out there. I did find one archaeologist who wanted to go, an American actually, and he says yes, he's thinking at his university to do this, but he wants to take his own ground-penetrating radar crew out there. And I said no, it's got to be on my terms. I'm sorry to be so adamant, but I need my ground penetrating radar. I didn't tell him what for, because, as I say, we want to go out there to check out the art place. So basically, that's the story. They can read it all there, see it all there, and thank you very much for having me. And naturally, they can go to your website and apparently pick up this recording. And if they didn't get my address, website, it would be on there. Would it be posted on there?
Yes, it will. Yes.
Good. Okay. Any questions or what or anything?
No, I think you've got an excellent memory of all these details, and you tell the story very well. So, no, I think, having read a lot about it to prepare for the interview, I think you've covered it very well. Those are the most important points, and I hope maybe you get something moving on this in time to discover the art, because after the work you put in, I can't help feeling that you deserve to.
Well, it's not for me, remember, it's for the world, and if it can help this planet and get some peace between the three religious groups, that they can go into one auditorium. Naturally, there's going to be a lot of these most people are going to say, no, we can't mix with the other religions, but you know, there's a lot of places, even when I lived in America, where they had church meetings and got different religious sects in there to discuss different things. And it's quite good. It put them on a friendly basis. Even in Gibraltar, we've got Jews, Christians and Muslims, and they're all living in peace. There's no problems. I mean, yeah, we all believe in the same creator, if one believes in God. It's all the same. It's all the same. So why should be all this animosity? Let's get things going. And if there's a place to do it, there's a lot of the atheists who didn't believe in it, and a lot of people don't believe in the Bible, but this would be another thing, by finding something in existence that's just an invisible God, they'll find something to do with the Bible that will verify a lot.
Yes, I agree. Now, one point, did you mention the name of your book?
Yeah, the book, at the moment, it's going to be called Ark Quest.
Right.
Which ARKQEST, you'll see all this written down there on the website. You're going to see it's written in some fonts which not people will realise what they are. A lot of people will realise. I don't know whether you realised it, but the fonts are actually, I did the ancient Hebrew script and changed them into the English alphabet. So those letters are partly made up of the ancient script.
Oh, right.
I did the whole alphabet on there because somebody said that we should make a movie sometime, and if they did, they'd need the credits, and it could be the credits on it. But, the book's going, first of all, the website they're going to look at, Jerry's Ark, www.jerrysarkquest.com, that is going to be a lot more than what I've just explained. That's going to last over two and a half hours. In fact, my last recording I did with somebody was 4 hours, and that was a bit too much, but still. I've also been going on for some cruise ships to do some lectures on cruise ships. I've just been invited to some, so things are going happening there. And hopefully we're going to get the word out to get the archaeologists and get all this going to help this planet, because I won't be around too long. I'm 77 years young, old, whatever you want to call it, and there's got to be young blood to carry on all this, and a lot of things have got to carry on, so hopefully we can get it done soon. But thank you very, very much, and I thank Don for letting me use his services. And if you want me to come back later on, maybe I can come back and talk about things a bit more. Thank you very much.
Well, I have to thank you indeed, Jerry, for coming on, and it's a very, very interesting story. Your experiences are well worth listening to and reading about. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Okay, I hope that I didn't sound too rushy, but I'm trying to squeeze a lot in the time you're giving
me. No.
Okay, you take care. God bless you, or if one believes in God or whatever you're believing, be well, and good for this planet. Take care.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
Cheerio, Jerry.
Bye.
Well, friends, that was quite a long interview, but full of interesting detail that Jerry's experienced himself. Now, next week, I've got Simon Stidivar. From the information I've got, it would seem that he's something of an expert on the lost knowledge from the Atlantean times, and he uses that to help other people. So we'll learn more about that in the program when he comes on for interview. So thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can make it next week. Thank you very much. God bless you all.